party members would be found guilty of anti-Muslim prejudice.
Well, joining us today to talk about Islamophobia in the UK and elsewhere, we have Ammar Kazmi, who is an anti-imperialist political activist who's recently finished a master's degree in human rights law. He previously worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign and later worked in the UK Parliament. And Farah Kutena, originally from and raised in Al-Quds, from one of the last Palestinian families in the Old City. She is also the founder of Key 48, a campaign calling for the immediate right of return of all Palestinian refugees and a referendum amongst the global Palestinian community on the future of Palestine. Welcome to the show, both of you. Farah, let me come straight to you because you've been able to join me in the studio, which I appreciate. Just tell me, why are we seeing so much anti-Muslim hatred? And not only that, but it's boiling over to a proportion where people feel that it's okay to physically assault innocent Muslims in the street. Why is it getting that bad?
It's a culmination of multiple reasons. I think one of those reasons would be kind of the way in which Muslims have been depicted for the past few decades in TV series, in movies, in Hollywood, which we know has links to the CIA, kind of going along with any kind of US foreign policy that's fitting at the time. And then also we have within that culmination is British government policies, kind of prevent and other Islamophobic policies, and also kind of the attitudes of British governments at the time. You know, we know there's a rampant Islamophobia within the Conservative Party. We've had a Prime Minister, like, for example, Boris Johnson, who was extremely Islamophobic, never even really apologised, you know, let alone actually was held accountable for the Islamophobic remarks he made. And we know that there was a direct impact by those remarks. We know that his remark referring to Muslim women as letterboxes, as burglars, we know that the, you know, Islamophobic attacks on Muslim women increased by over 300% just as a direct result of that single comment he made. So it's a culmination of many factors.
Ammar, you're joining us over Skype, and again, welcome to the show. Just tell me, in your opinion, who's more to blame for this atmosphere of hostility towards Muslims? Do you think that it's just politicians who are to blame, or perhaps the media has a major role in causing this problem?
Well, I think it's definitely both. I mean, the British media, which of course includes print, broadcast and radio, has played and continues to play a very, very large role in stoking Islamophobia. And I think this is a very important question because the media, by and large, is an extension of the British state. So I think there's not really that clear-cut divorce between politicians and the British media. They kind of work in tandem with each other, particularly the government of the day. And the British state, of course, has been a pioneer of 21st century Islamophobia across the globe, particularly in the post-9/11 period. There's almost no media outlet in Britain that is not, at least doctrinally, an extension of the British state. There's no countercultural newspaper, television show, or radio program, really. And all of the media news outlets have dedicated liaison on staff that report to or are directly paid by the British security services in order to produce content directly for them. And similarly, defense correspondents are essentially embedded in the Ministry of Defense, regurgitating state propaganda. And on key issues of security policy, international policy, and of course, Muslims in Britain are a highly securitized community and are of special interest as well in terms of international policy. There's very little that is produced in, you know, broadcast, print, and radio that's not directly generated by the state or that leans heavily on the state for both its line and its expert contributors. So I think they kind of work in tandem with each other.
But Ammar, there's also this kind of issue which is pushed. They're like conspiracy theories, misconceptions that have become quite popular in large parts of society. This idea that Muslims are the ones that are coming over here, trying to change the West, bringing their own religious practices, trying to basically a creeping Sharia. That's the idea that's being pushed around now. Do you think that there's where is this coming from? Why is this the issue that people look at Muslims with such mistrust?
I think the problem is because Britain is undergoing a huge identity crisis, and this isn't something new. This has been happening for decades. There's been a huge well of insecurity about Britishness in political discourse. And the reasons why Muslims have been attacked is because, you know, in the shadow of this declining British Empire, we've maintained our identity and they haven't, and they're confused about their identity. The decline of Christianity in particular has, I think, come as a shock to the values of society and to what people think Britain is conceptually. In the recent census, we saw that Britain really isn't any longer a Christian country. There's a huge amount of atheists and agnostic people here in Britain, but people still seem to think, well, we have our Christian cultural values, and these Muslims, these foreign barbarians are here to subvert our, you know, the beauty of Christendom. So I think it's primarily because Brits themselves are undergoing this identity crisis.
Let me come back to you, Farah, and just ask about the Islamophobia comes in different forms. There's obviously street thugs and right-wing terrorists who commit violent acts against Muslims directly. But there's also state-backed efforts which are deemed Islamophobic, like the Prevent Countering Extremism strategy, which is basically a government-backed initiative to try and root out extremism. But there seems to be an obsession with Muslims in this policy. Just tell us a little bit about Prevent and also your own personal experiences with this strategy.
Yeah, so Prevent is, you know, a counter-terrorism strategy, a wider strategy of another policy called Contest, and it's very relevant to point out this is a policy created and formed by the Conservative Party, a right-wing party. You know, it states that it's to target extremism, but actually it's an attempt by a right-wing government to purge its left-wing citizens. And what you'll find amongst the Muslim community in the UK is that they do sit on the left. They endorse kind of socialist policies. The Muslim community really gathered behind, for example, Jeremy Corbyn in his attempts to become prime minister as well. So really they've kind of exploited Prevent to target kind of a left-wing voting base, to criminalise kind of views such as being pro-Palestine, such as, many views, even, you know, being supportive of something like Black Lives Matter, and kind of all these views that do sit on the left of the political spectrum. And from my own personal experiences of Prevent, when I was at university, it was massively used to crush our freedom of speech, our freedom of expression, when it came to Palestine, but then also marginalising and criminalising kind of Muslim students' right to express their religion on campus. We had members of staff fulfilling their Prevent duty, which would involve them actually kind of turning Islamic prayer rooms into multi-faith rooms, destroying prayer mats, destroying Qurans as well.
Oh, wow.
Kind of just criminalising Muslim students on campus.
So basically, if you're a Muslim who perhaps expresses political views that are not in line with how the state's worldview, pro-Palestine sentiment, for example, I think I've even read reports of students who have accidentally said, I live in a terrorist house, and it's been misinterpreted to mean a terrorist house. Mm-hmm. Then in comes Prevent, teachers report on students, and Muslim kids are basically treated like they're criminals or terrorists.
There was one notable case of a secondary school student. He was a Muslim student. And he was simply wearing a Free Palestine badge on his school uniform. And the police raided his house because teachers then reported him to Prevent, using their Prevent duty.
Well, those are some very valid points you mentioned. But of course, Islamophobia isn't just a problem in the UK, but is prevalent in all non-Muslim nations around the world. Two particularly bad cases of state-sponsored Islamophobia can be found in India and France, as the following report explains.
The rise of nationalist politics and Hindu fundamentalism has led to the marginalisation and discrimination of Muslims in India. The ruling BJP party in particular has been accused of discriminating against Muslims. In 2019, it passed the controversial Citizenship Amendment Act, which offered citizenship to non-Muslim refugees from neighbouring countries while excluding Muslims. The law sparked widespread protests and condemnation from human rights groups and the international community. In the media, Muslims are often depicted as terrorists, criminals, and anti-national elements, which has contributed to the rise of hate crimes and vigilantism against Muslims. Muslims were also blamed for the spread of the COVID-19 virus, and were subjected to discrimination and violence. Lynchings of Muslims have become more common, with mobs targeting individuals suspected of consuming or selling beef, which is considered sacred by Hindus. Muslims have also been excluded from employment opportunities and denied access to education and healthcare. Meanwhile, France has the largest Muslim population in Europe, with estimates suggesting that there are between 5 and 6 million Muslims living in the country. However, they're often subjected to discrimination, social exclusion, and hate crimes. The French government has a strict separation of church and state and has banned the wearing of religious symbols in public spaces, including the hijab, niqab, and burqa. The powerful far-right National Front Party, led by Marine Le Pen, has campaigned on an anti-immigrant and anti-Islam platform, using fear-mongering tactics to appeal to voters. The party has also been accused of promoting hate speech and inciting violence against Muslims. Daesh terror attacks in France have also contributed to Islamophobia. These attacks have led to a sense of fear and mistrust amongst the wider population, with Muslims being unfairly blamed and subjected to discrimination and hate crimes. In 2021, President Emmanuel Macron introduced a new law that aimed to combat so-called Islamist separatism and promote secularism. The law includes measures such as increasing oversight of mosques and Muslim organizations, as well as restrictions on homeschooling and the issuance of halal certificates.
So there you go, some prominent examples of blatant Islamophobia in other countries. Ammar, let me bring you back in on this. Now, of course, Islamophobia is a kind of European continent-wide epidemic and has been for quite some time. We've seen a rising trend in Quran burnings, for example, which has been defended. These are far-right protests, actions which have been defended by leaders of European countries, particularly in Scandinavia and elsewhere. And of course, in France, as we've seen, there seems to be a rise in anti-Muslim sentiment in the highest levels of political life there. Could you just tell us, are you concerned that what we're seeing in France and elsewhere could be the direction in which the UK is going in? And just how far will this go? I mean, it looks to me as if we could be returning to 1930s Europe, where minorities were put into concentration camps.
Well, I am very concerned, and certainly the example of India is very apposite in terms of what you just mentioned about the 1930s, given that the Hindutva ideology that the BJP subscribes to and the RSS movement takes great inspiration from Nazism and European renaissance in general. I think that, you know, as Islamophobia, as you say, is a European continent-wide phenomenon, it's also a global phenomenon. We do need to be concerned about the happenings in other countries. Of course, what's happening in those other countries isn't directly comparable. What's happening in France, for example, is very much related to the fact that it's, you know, a republic, whereas Britain's a constitutional monarchy. The republic sees itself as a vanguard that imposes its values on others. But we shouldn't ever be complacent about what happens there, because often what we see with these sorts of trends is that these tactics are almost battle-tested in one area of the world, and then they end up expanding to another. Particularly in the European continent, we've seen trends in terms of legislation and banning and the liquidation of Islamic assets happening not just in France, but in Germany, in Austria, and in other European countries. So we should never be under the illusion that we aren't rapidly heading in that direction here in Britain. It's potentially dangerous and complacent to engage in a game of kind of relativized victimhood, because that will, as you've rightly mentioned, could end in, you know, a march to the death camps. Islamophobia is a global industry, a global problem, and we have to be very cautious about it in this society. Otherwise, who knows, we could be in the position of those Muslims in France or in India.
Farah, obviously there is a massive issue with this, and we could talk about different countries specifically. But one thing which I find very interesting is that there's this idea that Muslims who emigrate here and settle here, they should perhaps be grateful that they live in a country where they have perhaps a bit more freedoms than they do in countries like India, where there are purges against Muslims that take place in the streets. Not necessarily as bad as that here yet, but I think that there are some who would say to Muslims, well, you should be grateful, you should be more British as a result, you shouldn't be complaining so much. What's your response to that?
I think it's quite an outrageous, sentiment. There's nothing really that Muslims should be grateful for being here. I've witnessed my Muslim friends have, female Muslim friends have their hijabs torn off. You know, the rhetoric of Tommy Robinson has led to actions like these, and we see even just a few years ago these letters being posted around people's homes saying, you know, punish a Muslim day and kind of offering points to harm Muslims.
Yes, those are just a few examples. But Amar, let me ask you about a specific phenomenon which has occurred recently. There's the rise in Quran burnings in Europe. The reason I come back to this is because we saw a massive Muslim reaction to recent burnings which took place in Scandinavia. Turkey got involved. They vetoed a bid by Sweden to join NATO, and it turned into a massive political scandal. And some may argue that the Muslim reaction to that basically achieved some results. So what I want to ask you about is how Muslims should respond to incidents of Islamophobia in whatever form they take. Do you think we need more street protests? Do you think we need more Muslims in politics? What's the solution?
Well, I think that certainly we need more advocacy for Muslims, and we need more organization. I think one of the biggest reasons why Islamophobes, not just in Britain, but particularly in the Nordic countries, where there are even fewer Muslims than there are, you know, in Britain and other countries, is there's a lack of an institutional, organizational defense for Muslim communities. And that, because we don't have that, it means that there's no real deterrent for these would-be attackers. And when we did have those protests, we saw that it was effective. But these broad institutional failures among Muslims globally, that is what really has emboldened these enemies of Islam and Muslims to take these sorts of actions, which, of course, is encouraged by the rhetoric of various governments. The problem that we have in the Muslim community that, you know, the Jewish community, for example, doesn't have is we don't have a sort of structure of state-funded community defense organizations like the Community Security Trust, which is a lobbying group that's funded by the British government. There's no, you know, Muslim shomrim. There's no organized community defense force. There are no legal organizations that lobby explicitly to protect Muslim interests. It's not even necessarily about Muslims going into politics. It's about Muslims having the capacity to be able to influence political change, which doesn't necessarily need to happen by people being elected to parliament. They can become lobbyists, and they can we can develop organizations that actually have clout politically. So I think we do have to come together to protect our communal interests, because the ones that exist at the moment, organizations in Britain, for example, like Tell Mama, have been so heavily subverted, in my view, and penetrated by agents of causes that are completely hostile to Muslims. So we don't really have any real advocacy organizations.
Farah, I want to ask you the same question. What do you think the solution is? Because as we've discussed in this show, there is many different types of Islamophobia. We have entire governments that are supportive of this viewpoint. And right now in the UK, they won't even define Islamophobia. There isn't even a government-recognized definition of the term Islamophobia, so we don't even know how to combat it if we can't even define it. So what do you mean? What's the solution?
I think the solution here is to put more kind of leaders of Muslim communities in positions of power and influence. So they're, you know, they're the ones really deciding kind of what policies are Islamophobic, what policies, you know, are harmful to the Muslim community. You know, the likes of tokenism in regards to the Conservative Party, where they place these politicians who may be people of color or maybe of a certain religion, but then still, you know, kind of implement the same harsh policies that their white counterparts would implement isn't good enough anymore. We actually need representation behind those kind of token figures.
I'm going to bring it to you, Amar. The same question to you. There is an issue with political representation, I think, because Hamza Yousaf, the leader of the SNP now in Scotland, he's being criticised as to whether he's even a Muslim anymore because he's seen as compromising on his Islamic values to obtain that position. But what about the idea of if you are principled like Jeremy Corbyn and stand by your views, then you'll be denied the opportunity with the establishment turning on you to keep you out of positions of power. What do you think? Do you think that there's any chance of gaining any real political representation for Muslims in the West?
I do think it's very difficult if you're a practicing Muslim to become a politician of any influence in this country. And that's why now I'm primarily focusing on other ways in which we can leverage our power. And I think having, you know, strong communal organizations is one way in which Muslims can assert themselves. Because, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, for example, who was seen by the security establishment in Britain as being politically Muslim because of his proximity to Muslim communities in Britain, he was, as one commentator pointed out, a victim of Islamophobia in and of himself, and he wasn't even a Muslim. And you can see the way in which Muslims are attacked because the aim of these individuals, people like Keir Starmer, for example, who are servants of the security establishment, is they want to, and they've been quite successful, actually, in ejecting Muslims from public life. And they're doing that at the behest of not only the security state here in Britain, but also at the behest of Zionist entryists who represent the interests of a hostile foreign regime. So my view is the current political situation is very difficult to be a practicing Muslim. We should be focusing on other ways in which we can leverage our power. Of course, that doesn't mean we give up on politics, but we also need to be realistic about the way in which the tide is flowing at this particular moment in time. And that's my personal view.
A very good point to end on. Thank you very much to both my guests, and thank you at home as well. But that's all we have time for on this edition of the show. But don't worry, we'll be back next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
According to reports, the UK spent over $200 million to bid a final farewell to its longest-serving monarch. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote in this regard, the British government spent £162 million $204 million on Queen Elizabeth II's funeral and related events, the Treasury revealed this week. The monarch's death on September 8 was followed by 10 days of national mourning, which concluded with the state funeral on September 19. Queen Elizabeth II died aged 96 at Balmoral Castle in Scotland, having been the longest-serving British monarch. Her death was a moment of national significance, claimed Chief Secretary to the Treasury John Glenn, adding that the government had to ensure the surrounding events ran smoothly and with appropriate level of dignity, while at all times ensuring the safety and security of the public, he said. The breakdown of costs provided by the Treasury showed that the Home Office paid the largest amount of £74 million, followed by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, which covered £57.4 million. The Scottish Government paid £18.8 million, while the Welsh Government and Northern Ireland Office paid about £2 million each. According to the Treasury, the Scottish and Welsh governments and the Northern Ireland Office were fully refunded for their respective costs. An estimated 250,000 members of the public saw the late British monarch lying in state in London during the mourning period, with many queuing for hours to pay their respects. The Queen was buried at St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle, Berkshire. The National Police Chiefs Council described the event as the largest ever operation for the Metropolitan Police ahead of the opening and closing ceremonies for the London Olympics in 2012. The Queen's successor and son, King Charles III, was crowned on May 6 during a three-day weekend of coronation celebrations, which are projected to have cost between £50 million and £100 million. Press TV reported, meanwhile, a new study has revealed that only 3 out of 10 Britons believe that a monarchy is very important, as support towards the monarchy nosedives to a record low. A new survey by the National Center for Social Research says that 29% of those quizzed said the monarchy was very important, 26% said it was quite important, 20% said it was not very important, and 25% said it was not at all important. Abolish. British Social Attitudes data shows that public support for the monarchy has fallen to a record low, the study read. Conducted for this year's British Social Attitudes Survey, BSA, and based on over 6,638 interviews, the study shows that people agreeing with the monarchy have dropped to the lowest percentage since the study began in 1983. In 2022, when the Queen's Platinum Jubilee took place, 35% of respondents said the monarchy is very important, which contributed to the first increase since 2012. Guy Goodwin, chief executive at the National Center for Social Research, said, "While we are observing a downward trend in support for the monarchy, it is clear from the data that important national events and celebrations, such as jubilees, marriages, and births, have a clear and positive effect on the society's view toward the monarchy." The latest survey is the direct manifestation of how the Britons are not looking up to the newly crowned King Charles as their monarch. There is also a consistent trend that younger people are less likely than older people to say it is very important that Britain has a monarchy. Previously, the YouGov survey carried out just over 2 weeks before Charles and the Queen Consort are set to be crowned, found that 51% of adults questioned believe the ceremony should not be funded by the government. The anti-monarchy pressure group Republic is one of the foremost leading groups which aims to abolish monarchy rule from the islands. The Republic group held a massive anti-monarchy protest event, and it said thousands showed up at Trafalgar Square along with Abolish the Monarchy placards.
Economic divide.
What do you think of when you hear the word sanctions? Of course, the U.S. That is the most common answer because it's the country that has executed the most sanctions. Then countries like Russia, Iran, and China may come to mind who have been on the receiving end. But what if we told you the U.S. sanctions also puts the U.S. at the receiving end of losing revenues? That is the topic of this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, U.S. sanctions. U.S. foreign policy objectives is what the U.S. uses sanctions for, but it hurts U.S. economic interests. Also, sanctions have proven ineffective, for example, when it comes to Iran. Then we're going to take a look at the types of sanctions. There are ones that are called unilateral. There are also ones that are called secondary. The unilateral ones cost American firms quite a bit of money. The secondary ones also compel others to join, which means there still will be loss of revenues. Then the U.S. loss of revenues. Over 20 countries have been sanctioned so far, which contributes to the loss of revenues, like on Iran, Russia, and China. Billions of dollars in losses. Overall, that decreases the U.S. standing. For years, the U.S. has used the dominance of its currency, the U.S. dollar, to punish other countries for not following its policies. U.S. economic sanctions are increasingly being used to promote the full range of American foreign policy objectives. The U.S. has imposed two-thirds of the world's sanctions since the 1990s. As of March 2022, countries or regions subjected to U.S. sanctions include Afghanistan, Cuba, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, North Korea, Russia, Venezuela, Yemen, and China. Destabilization of the sanctioned country is the frequent goal of the U.S. sanctions program. Destabilization occurs when people in the sanctioned country lose confidence in the government's ability to operate the country. There are two types of sanctions. Unilateral sanctions, said to be rarely effective. However, the secondary sanctions are more complicated. Simple terms, it includes trying to compel others to join U.S. sanctions in attacking the targeted country. But after years of imposing sanctions, it has now become apparent that the sanctions have failed to change the behavior of the sanctioned countries, but they have barred American companies from economic opportunities. Time to take a look at some of the online posts on this. First, the website where it said economic sanctions, too much of a bad thing. Unilateral sanctions are rarely effective. In a global economy, unilateral sanctions tend to impose greater costs on American firms than on the target, which can usually find substitute sources of supply and financing. Next up, another website. Even the Treasury Department admits sanctions don't work. And is the U.S. finally recognizing that economic warfare is not achieving its foreign policy objectives anywhere? It goes on to say U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said that U.S. sanctions on Iran simply are not working, or at least working much less than we would ideally like. Adding, Iran is just the latest example of how sanctions rarely, if ever, meet their stated goals, yet consistently succeed in causing mass civilian suffering and casualty. Indeed, that is the case when it comes to the Islamic Republic. Next up, we took a look at actually a book. It's the first time we've done that, but we figured why not. It's not a social media post, but author Agatha Damaris, her book, which was referenced in this previous entry, actually, it has a title that should make the U.S. rethink its sanctions policy. It's titled Backfire, How Sanctions Reshape the World Against U.S. Interests. It says, Backfire, financial sanctions are designed to inflict pain on the people of a targeted country with the hope that they will get fed up and advocate for political change. Again, the author, Agatha Damaris, saying that. Also, she says, How Sanctions Reshape the World Against U.S. Interests is the title of the book, which goes into lengthy description of how sanctions actually backfire. And finally, another website, Going Alone on Economic Sanctions Hurts U.S. More Than the Foes, where it said using trade as a weapon of foreign policy has harmed America's economic interests in the world without significantly advancing national security. It says U.S. sanctions have cost American exporters $15 billion to $19 billion in lost annual sales overseas, causing long-term damage to U.S. companies, such as lost market share and reputations abroad as unreliable suppliers. All right, those were some of the posts. Interesting that there was not many positive, at least posts that we found, when it comes to sanctions in terms of not only their efficiency, but also how it hurts the U.S. itself and its economy. All right, let me introduce our guests for this first segment of the UNA. First up, we have Eamon McKinney. He's a sinologist, nominated for a Nobel Prize, as the CEO of CBN Global in China. All right, welcome to the program, Eamon. Taking a look at economic sanctions, well, they are increasingly being used to promote the full range of American foreign policy objectives. That is a well-known fact. But basically, they are no more than just expressions of U.S. Preferences that hurt American economic interests. I'm sure the U.S. knows that. Without changing the targeted country's behavior for the better, how do U.S. sanctions hurt the U.S.? How do you see it?
Well, primarily, they do hurt them financially. It's, I mean, if you take, for example, the case Trump put sanctions on American tech products to China, immediately the tech center in America lost about $50 billion a year in annual sales, which didn't particularly bother the Chinese. They just got the products from somewhere else. I don't think the economic losses are the major concern to the Americans. The way it is, they can always print more money. The main thing is that they maintain their control. There's a thing called revenge capitalism. I mean, if you look at Cuba, Cuba's been under sanctions and embargo for 63 years. And obvious economic opportunities there for American companies were immense, but they were quite prepared to sacrifice those to make a point. If you defy the empire, you will get penalized. Does it hurt American business, American companies, the American economy? Most definitely, but I don't think that is their main concern. Their main concern right now is maintaining control.
Okay. Wow. Making an example of Cuba all these years. Obviously something that is and should be a concern for U.S. Of course, a lot of businesses in the U.S. would love to do business with Cuba. Some obviously are doing that under the eye of the Treasury. Anyways, let me introduce our next guest. Joining us now is Dean Admometis. He's the editor at the Schiller Institute. Dean, welcome to Economic Divide. Explain to us the types of sanctions, which is my next question to you, because basically there are two types that we have, unilateral sanctions, which are said to be rarely effective and actually cause American firms quite a bit of money than on the target itself. And also, we're taking a look at how there's another type of sanctions, and those are called the secondary sanctions. And secondary sanctions are set to also cost U.S. firms quite a bit of money. What is the point of the U.S. exercising sanctions that don't work the way they should and at the same time cost U.S. businesses lots of revenue?
Well, again, it's the whole logic. It's the whole logic or illogic of sanctions. The United States, you know, industrial countries, like, for instance, Russia, and the war that's now, you know, killing Ukrainians 8 times faster than it's killing Russians. And the U.S. has totally cynical policy. Oh, we want to punish Russia to the last Ukrainian. And what is this doing? This has cut off a tremendous market for the United States technology in the oil sector, in the energy sector, in the high tech sector, aviation, aerospace, you name it. These are exactly the sectors of the U.S. economy which should be strengthened and are weakening, are being weakened. And this doesn't, you know, American industrialists aren't benefiting by this at all. Maybe the only so-called industrialists are the so-called military industrial complex.
Time now for the Infinews section of the program. First up, that's the topic that's appropriate for this program. We're going to take a look at EU possibility of EU sanctions on China. That's right. EU is planning to punish China for trade ties with Russia. A new sanctions package has been reported to target 7 Chinese firms. Now, the businesses have reportedly been accused of selling equipment that could be used by Moscow in weapons manufacturing. Wonder how that's going to affect the relationship, trade relationship, especially between the EU and China. Next up, I'll take a look at this conference, which is really important. Can't stress it enough. It's called the New World Order Geometry. Basically, it was an Iranian conference that was held here in the capital, Tehran, and highlighted the need for adaptation to the changing global order. A quote out of that entry was that the geometry of the New World Order conference discussed changing global order, the rise of China, and the need for the U.S. and allies to adapt. It went on to say China has surpassed the U.S. as the world's largest economy and its determination to invest across Asia. Again, can't stress enough how important this conference was. Next up, this is something, again, that's developing. Iran-Saudi relationship has been taken to another level because the Iranian economy minister, Qanduzi, visited Saudi Arabia. This was the first visit by a senior Iranian official. He headed a high-ranking economic delegation. And the visit featured participation at a meeting of the Islamic Development Bank. And finally, an announcement made by Italy when it comes to China's Silk Road Initiative. Exit has been called by China, where it said it may exit this new Silk Road, considering withdrawing from China's Belt and Road Initiative. Italy said, given the state of relations between the U.S. and China, we cannot remain an ally of the U.S. and at the same time remain in the BRI, which is the Belt and Road Initiative. So much for the relationship with the U.S., how it can be toxic, to say the least.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for the in-depth section of this program. It is a well-known fact that the U.S. option of using trade as a weapon of foreign policy in order to gain concessions from the country that it is targeting has not only had a low success rate, in some instances it has not even worked, like in the case of Iran. Well, in this in-depth section, we will look at how U.S. sanctions have hurt America's economic interests. First of all, sanctions can be expensive for American businesses, from workers to even farmers. Sanctions do affect the U.S. economy by reducing revenues of U.S. companies and also individuals. Sanctions cost U.S. companies billions of dollars a year in lost sales and return on investment, and cost many thousands of workers their jobs. Next, we took a look at a study in which the United States imposed thousands of trade sanctions on three dozen countries. The study concluded that these sanctions cost American exporters a minimum of $15 billion, up to $19 billion in lost annual sales overseas. Next, this means the impact, that is. Consequentially, it means employment among U.S. export industries would be reduced by 200,000 or more jobs, and that the U.S. and that the shift in U.S. employment, well, that's going to result in a loss of roughly about $800 million to $1 billion annually. Now, this has also caused some long-term impacts. For example, it damages U.S. Companies when it comes to the U.S. losing market share, and also the U.S. reputation abroad. That means that people would look at the U.S. as being an unreliable supplier. Now, even though the cost in relation to the U.S. GDP may be very small, the cost may be significant for individual firms or industries. Even if sanctions cost the U.S. economy roughly between 0.5 and 1% of the GDP, the total GDP, that still adds to a recurring cost of roughly $10 to $15 billion per year. Now, competition also plays a factor when it comes to U.S. sanctions. The U.S. may be the world's largest economy, but its global economic leverage, well, that then becomes limited. That is limited, because the U.S., well, it accounts for only 13% of the world's merchandise exports and then 16% of its imports. Well, if it wants to punish another country by unilaterally withholding exports, things like farm products, let's say, or computers or oil drilling services, well, other global suppliers, they are more than happy to fill in the gap. And then finally, let's take a look at case and point. In this case, we picked Cuba. Cuba has undergone the most prolonged economic blockade in U.S. history. Back in 2009, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce estimated that the embargo has cost the U.S. economy $1.2 billion per year in lost sales and exports. And that's just one country where the U.S. has lost that amount of money. Let's bring back our guest, Eamon McKinney, who's a sinologist nominated for a Nobel Prize, rejoins us in order to tell us what he thinks about this. All right, Ian, welcome back to Economic Divide. My question to you here is the loss of revenue which the U.S. has earned, that could have earned, well, this can be applied to the most sanctioned countries in the world. Basically, Russia at the top, then Iran. We can mention also China, where the U.S. has lost tremendous revenues in the billions of dollars. On the last count, the U.S. has sanctioned over 20 countries. That could be up to 36 countries. You have the loss of revenues on the one hand and the ineffectiveness on the other. Again, example being Iran. Isn't this a lose-lose proposition by the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that's part of the mindset, that they can inflict damage and they can survive it better than somebody else. But I think they've been very badly miscalculating in all of these cases. In a lot of cases, I mean, the sanctions are tied in with the fact that most of these sanctioned countries have a lot of their money being held in America, Iran among them. Iran was supposed to be getting back the money that was, stolen after the Iranian revolution. And the US has refused to give it back ever since. But they're doing the same thing with Russian money right now. So nobody has any trust in the American financial system. Nobody trusts the Americans to look after their money. And, you know, the way that America has weaponized and abused its privilege of having the world's reserve currency is backfiring on it spectacularly. And that's why I think everybody, or most of the countries in the world now outside the Western dominated bloc, are now moving towards the BRIC conglomerate.
All right, thank you for that. Again, keeping in mind that sanctions not only hurt the countries that are being sanctioned by the U.S., but again, it comes back to the U.S. hurting itself when it comes to its loss of revenues. Bringing back Dean Admomidas, editor of the Schiller Institute. Dean, welcome back to Economic Divide. There's a loss of revenue when it comes to the U.S. and the sanctions that it imposes on other countries. Basically, it's a boomerang effect, in a sense. When you take a look at the way that the U.S. has lost revenues, it seems like it doesn't care that that is occurring, which obviously leads to things like job losses, which hurts the American society as a whole. The revenues lost could be obviously applied to other segments of the American economic cycle. But the U.S. refuses to do that, goes ahead with the sanctions, and in some cases, the sanctions don't even work, like in the case of Iran. Isn't this a lose-lose proposition when it comes to sanctions and the way that the U.S. is exercising it?
Well, it is a lose-lose proposition, but it's, you know, American, as far as I can, as far as I'm concerned, American foreign policy is bankrupt at this point. And these sanctions are the, you know, are the front end of that failure. Because they're meaningless. They don't force, you know, countries manage to become large countries like Russia, China. I mean, Iran is a, I mean, people don't realize that Iran is an enormous country with nearly 100 million people, with a highly developed economy. It would do much better if all these countries would do much better if there weren't these sanctions, because all the countries would do much better if they had access to whatever high-tech American technology has to offer. And of course, the U.S. would benefit from that, because this would be the market by which they can earn the revenues.
U.S. policymakers see sanctions as a low-cost tactic. Measures also have potent side effects that in some areas can even harm American interests. Many American businesses claim that the effects of even limited unilateral U.S. sanctions go well beyond targeted sectors. They also argue that the effects linger long after they are lifted because U.S. firms come to be regarded as unreliable suppliers. Sanctioned countries may avoid buying from U.S. exporters, even when sanctions are not in place, thus giving firms in other countries a competitive advantage in those markets. The secondary boycotts and extraterritorial sanctions are disturbing precedents that could increase the unreliable supplier effect in the future. These indirect effects may well extend beyond the sanctioned products and even beyond the time period sanctions are imposed. Washington's lack of interest in the side effects of its unilateral policies also united both friends and enemies against U.S. sanctions. There's also the loss of revenue which the U.S. could have earned. This can be applied to the most sanctioned countries in the world, Russia, then Iran, where the U.S. has lost tremendous revenues in the billions of dollars. China can be included in this group. Consequences of China's economic supremacy on the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions will extend beyond Chinese borders. When America ruled the world, U.S. sanctions were a powerful tool. Nobody ever wanted to get on the wrong side of the global policeman. However, times have changed. Now that China has emerged as an economic superpower, sanctioned countries have an alternative partner to turn to.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Abbasian. U.S. sanctions are counterproductive since they cut revenues for the U.S. itself. But here we want to give you another example of how the U.S. shoots itself in the foot, depriving itself of revenues, and that is its trade war with China. The United States has maintained steep tariffs on more than two-thirds of Chinese goods, with China retaliating with its own tariffs. This is while much of the cost of tariffs was passed on to U.S. consumers and businesses. The price of Chinese imports remained stable as the United States ramped up tariffs, which meant the brunt of the tariff burden is borne by U.S. consumers and companies. Of course, China has not sat around after the U.S. imposed sanctions on the country. It retaliated with tariffs of its own, which has hurt U.S. exports and led to the loss of jobs. For example, retaliatory Chinese tariffs caused U.S. goods and services exports to China to fall nearly 12% since 2017. U.S. exports to China alone support around 1.1 million U.S. jobs. As tariffs stifled exports, this dropped by nearly 134,000 jobs the following year. Other estimates and its effects on the economy indicate that the U.S.-China trade war has cost nearly 300,000 U.S. jobs from mid-2018 to mid-2022. For this year, the U.S. is also thinking of expanding U.S. tariffs of 25% to all trade with China. That would cost the U.S. $190 billion a year in GDP. If the U.S. is forced to sell half of its direct investments in China, that would cost American investors $25 billion a year in capital gains and up to $500 billion in GDP losses, the report said. U.S. businesses risk losing global competitiveness if sweeping policies force a separation from China. New York Federal Reserve researchers estimate that the trade war with China has erased a total of $1.7 trillion in market capitalization for U.S.-listed firms. And Joe Biden has taken this a step further and will soon sign into law U.S. investments by American businesses in China. Joe Biden says this is on national security grounds and not as a move to limit China's economic rise. Beijing, of course, is not buying that. And that does it for this Quick Take section. Hope you found it useful.
U.S. sanctions policy is not going to change. The U.S. believes that due to its influence on the world financial system, or should we say the grip that it has on the world financial system, and also its influence over the dollar, it can bully, that's right, bully other nations into succumbing to its will. But at what cost? Losing billions of dollars in revenues that it can certainly use for its own country? And all of this while the U.S. image is being tarnished worldwide, especially as a reliable trading partner, or overall the U.S. image being tarnished? I guess the U.S. thinks that that is a cost that it can afford. But I think it has to think twice because many are saying that it has caught up with it. That does it for this edition of the program. Hope you enjoyed it. This particular topic is very important to us. All of them really are, but this one, we'd like to hear from you to find out how we did and if you had any questions or whether the facts we presented served the purpose or not. From Mikhail Vitakvi and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Since the Republican Party won control of the House of Representatives in November of 2022, the United States has been locked in gridlock that could spark a major economic crisis. Republicans have refused to raise the U.S. debt ceiling unless President Joe Biden agrees to major spending cuts. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Agence France-Presse has covered this story and tells us more. The threat of a U.S. default was raised a notch on Friday, 19th of May, after a pause in debt ceiling talks between the White House and the Republican opposition, as the two sides wrangle with deep disagreements. Negotiators for President Joe Biden have been locked in talks with Republicans as they seek a deal to raise the U.S. borrowing limit